Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Ten Commandments when we come back. You know, over 3,000 years ago, before the science of meteorology was even thought of, old King Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 1 verse 7 that all of the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea isn't full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. Well, every year the continents and islands of this earth pour down into the oceans a stupendous volume of water. About 286,000 cubic miles of water flow into the oceans every year. Well, for century after century and millennium after millennium, this has been going on, and the sea hasn't increased its level by so much as an inch. Now, how is that possible? Well, we call it the circle or cycle of evaporation and precipitation. And the writer of Ecclesiastes said that the ocean maintains its level in spite of this gigantic annual influx because the rivers go back to the place from whence they came. And indeed they do. You know, every drop of rain that falls climbs back upon the Creator's elevator of evaporation to form themselves into clouds and then ride back to the head of their toboggan slide to begin their journey all over again. Well, in the modern science of meteorology, we understand this today. And the laws of meteorology are comprehended. Modern science has learned now what the writer of Ecclesiastes knew 3,000 years ago. And that's just one more of the many examples of science that we find in the Scripture. And this is one of the many lessons that we go through or teach here in the Mosaic Law School, conducted twice a year at the law school in Isabella, Missouri. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first? That's the place to start. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email, send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're reviewing the book, The Ten Commandments. Actually, it's not a very big book. It's 72 pages. Written by Roderick C. Meredith back about 1960, published by Ambassador College Press. Looking at the copyright there. And I haven't got a clue as to where you could get a copy of this book or booklet, so I have asked any of you listeners out there if you know where you can get a copy of this book. If there's anybody still publishing it, or if there's any of these old copies laying around someplace, you know, 50, 100, there will be a number of people calling us here at the Law Hour, and they will say, well, I heard your story, maybe a month or two from now, and they'll go, well, I heard your story on the archives here about the Ten Commandments. I'd like to get that book. Can you tell me where to get it? And the answer is no, I haven't got a clue. The reason I picked it up is because I've had it for many years, and like a lot of things, you know, I read a book or I see something, I say, God, I think I'll put that on the air. That's a pretty interesting story. And this guy, Roderick Meredith, has written one whale of a neat, interesting story. He's probably a religious guy, I'd guess from the tenor of the book. Probably a preacher or a priest or something. No, he's not a priest. Come to think of it, he told us the story about these fathers and priests and reverends and one thing and another in the Third Commandment, remember? But anyway, he wrote a dynamite story here, and I'd like to disseminate it and review it. Because I've said that there's nobody that has a good word about the Ten Commandments. I told you last time about Andy Rooney. He reviewed the Ten Commandments. Took 2 minutes. on 60 Minutes here some time back. He didn't have a good word about the Ten Commandments as a whole. He did have a couple of good words about three or four commandments that we still practice here. You know, like, thou shalt not steal and you shall do no murder. He didn't find too much fault with those. All the rest of them, though, he didn't have much use for. Now, this writer, Roderick Meredith, finds use for all 10 of the Ten Commandments. And I noticed that when I was a kid growing up, we used to believe that there was a great use to the Ten Commandments. And we taught them in our public schools. We taught children in public school that that theft was bad. And that murder and hurting people and killing people, that was bad. And that worshiping false gods was bad. And not keeping the Sabbath was bad. In fact, when I was a kid, let me tell you about this. When I was a kid, everybody in America kept the Sabbath. Did you know that? Yeah, by law. Did you know there was a Sabbath law in the United States of America? There was. We used to call these blue laws. Blue laws. And the blue laws came up. In fact, this was an interesting case. Came up back in the 1920s. And some Jewish guy challenged the blue law that said you have to close your store on Sunday. I think it was in Pennsylvania or New York, someplace back east. Anyway, he walked in and he said, listen, this blue law over here is unconstitutional because it impacts upon Jews unfairly. You see, we keep the Sabbath and we keep it on Saturday. So we close our stores voluntarily on Saturday. And then the law says that if we open our stores on Sunday, we get into trouble with the law and they're gonna punish us. Therefore, we should be able to keep our Sabbath on Saturday and you Christians can keep your Sabbath on Sunday. And so the Supreme Court came back about 1923, as I recall, and they said, oh no, if you guys want to take off on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, that's fine. But everybody's gonna take off on Sunday whether you like it or not. Got that? And so we Americans practiced the Sabbath, even in World War II. I can remember when I was a little kid, the mill whistle would blow. And, at 5 o'clock on Saturday, you know, they worked 6 days a week. They worked Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. And then the mill whistle would blow at 5 o'clock on Saturday night. Everybody came home and the world stopped. It just fell off a cliff. All day Sunday. You couldn't buy a postage stamp. Well, of course, the post office was closed on Sunday, but so was the cookhouse, the bunkhouse, and Brizard's store was closed. The mill was closed. You couldn't work. The Texaco station was closed. You couldn't buy an ice cream cone down at the cookhouse. You couldn't buy a gallon of gas, so you had to have your gasoline in your car. Well, it was during World War II. Most people didn't have a car anyway. The world stopped on Sunday. In fact, it was that way until about 1950, and then somebody woke up and said, we gotta have a separation of this church and state crap, and we gotta do away with the Sabbath thing. And so today, you know, as I speak, you know, hell, I don't even know if they put locks on Walmart stores or on gambling casinos because they never close. They're always open 24/7, you know, 24/7 around the clock. Year after year after year. So we don't practice the Sabbath in America anymore, but we used to. That's my point. We used to. Now, as this old boy David Barton pointed out, when we stopped praying in our public schools, we got a downside. And he documents that in his book, America to Pray or Not to Pray. So I'm going to push his book one more time on you. It's so good. It's $12. It's so good, so informative that you need a copy. That's why I keep telling you about it. It's Wall Builder Press, P.O. Box 397, Aledo, Texas, 76008. That's Aledo, A-L-E-D-O. I haven't got a clue as to where Aledo, Texas is. Just trust the post office at 76008, and they'll deliver your letter. If you send the guy about $12 or $14, just send him a $15 bill, and I'll bet you I'll send you the book postpaid. Or you can call him at 817-441-6044 and find out what the real price is. Last time I bought a copy, it was $12. 817-441-6044 for that book, America to Pray or Not to Pray. Now, the book I'm reviewing here, The Ten Commandments, is not available at any price anywhere that I know of, which is why I said, tell me where we can get some copies of it, would you? And then we will make that available. Now, Andy Rooney didn't have much to say about the Ten Commandments that was good, but this guy Meredith does. And he goes on to say, Jesus said that the Sabbath was made for man, and here we see that the Sabbath was made when man was made. clear back at the Garden of Eden, at creation. And it was made by the very divine person who later became Jesus Christ. So it was made by Jesus himself. It was made as an intrinsic part of the environment which surrounded man and which God made in the 7 days of creation. Notice here that God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, set it apart. Such an honor was not conferred on any of the preceding 6 days. When God blesses something, he bestows his divine favor upon it and his divine presence in it, that thing. And every word sanctify, the very word sanctify, means to set apart for holy use or purpose. The Sabbath is to be set apart for holy use or purpose. Thus we see that in the very act of creation, God himself put his divine favor upon and set apart for holy use and purpose a certain space of time, the most enduring thing that there is. So the Sabbath is a blessing, not a curse. And certainly this insight into the background of the Sabbath gives added meaning to God's command. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. And through Jesus Christ, God made the seventh day of the week holy, and on his authority as our creator, he commands us to keep it that way. The Sabbath then is holy time, and yet it was made for man as a great blessing to all of mankind, which includes all of you Japanese and Chinese and Bolivians as well. And our Creator knew that we would need a period of rest and worship every seventh day, and this is the basic purpose for which the Sabbath was created. Each of us tends to become overly absorbed in our daily cares and work and pleasure during the week. And our Creator foresaw this and set apart his Sabbath day as a consecrated time when we can completely forget about our daily routine and draw closer to the Creator in study, meditation, and prayer. Modern man desperately needs this period of time in which to have real communion with his Maker, taking time to think upon God and to worship him, to pray, study, meditate upon the purpose for human existence and upon God's revealed laws of life. And all this adds great strength and meaning to man's life the other 6 days of the week. So the Sabbath is one of the greatest blessings that's ever been bestowed upon the human family. And it's a special covenant. The command to keep the Sabbath is the only one in which we are enjoined to remember, and yet it is the one command which many ministers and religious people seem most anxious to forget. Many have reasoned that since the Sabbath was contained in what is called the Book of the Covenant in Exodus 20 through 24, therefore it is no longer binding on us today who are under the new covenant of Christ. Such people seem to forget that, as we have already shown, God made the Sabbath day holy back at creation, long before there were any Jews, and long before there was any old covenant was ever made with Israel. And they also forget that God doubly commanded the Sabbath by making a special and separate covenant with his people to keep it. This special covenant is spoken of in Exodus chapter 31. So God told Moses, "You speak also unto the children of Israel, saying, Truly my Sabbaths you shall keep." Now notice the word Sabbaths plural here, and I'm going to underline that, because I showed you last time how to code plead this out, remember? "For it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Eternal that does sanctify you." In Exodus 31:13, here the Sabbath is spoken of as a sign that identified the true God, the God of Israel. But how is it a sign? It is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever, because in 6 days the Eternal made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. I'll put a little bracket around that, because, you know, most people believe that evolution comes into play, and creation took billions and billions of years. So says Carl Sagan. God here is, you know, more than once. I mean, he's repeated himself more than once. He said, "I did this in 7 days." God commands, "Wherefore, the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath to observe the Sabbath throughout their generations for a perpetual covenant." Perpetual covenant. That's a perpetual contract. Throughout your generations. Have our generations ceased to exist, children? Well, mine haven't. So the Gordon generations are still going on. And that's a perpetual contract. Here is an everlasting covenant to identify the true God of Israel, the Creator. Now God himself rested on the seventh day, and he made it holy in memory of his work of creation, and it's an everlasting sign that he is the Creator. The Sabbath is of vital importance, and throughout the Old Testament, the history of the nation of Israel and Judah show that they were blessed in every way when they worshiped the true God and kept his Sabbath day. But when they neglected this command to remember his Sabbath and began to worship the created instead of the Creator, they went off into pagan idolatry, human sacrifice, bloodshed, war, and then they were punished by God through the stripes of men. Now, approximately 721 to 718 BC, the nation of Israel went into the greatest national captivity and punishment that's ever befallen any nation in all of history. The reason for that punishment is described by God himself in Ezekiel chapter 20. So after describing how he brought Israel out of Egypt and gave them his statutes and judgments, God says that, moreover, also I gave them my Sabbaths to be a sign between me and them, that they might know that I am the Eternal that sanctifies them. But the house of Israel rebelled against me in the wilderness. They walked not in my statutes, and they despised my judgments, which if a man do, he shall even live in them. And my Sabbaths they greatly polluted. Notice this Sabbaths. My Sabbaths, plural. Then he said, I would pour out my fury upon them in the wilderness to consume them. All right, so then there's a punishment that comes from Sabbath breaking. Now, if you want to take a look a little closer here in Leviticus chapter 26, verse 34, national captivity is the punishment for Sabbath breaking. And we Americans are about to go into national captivity right along with all you Canadians, Australians, and New Zealanders. And I suspect the majority of you Western Europeans. Over and over throughout this chapter, God indicts the nation of Israel for rebelling against him and specifically condemns them for breaking his Sabbaths, plural. So let me pause right here and point out to you that there are seven annual Sabbaths, for all you Advents out there, seven annual Sabbaths, as well as the weekly Sabbath. And you'll see that in Leviticus chapter 23. Leviticus 23, I'll tell you about those seven annual holy days, beginning with the Passover and Days of Unleavened Bread, Feast of Weeks, then the Feast of Trumpets, Day of Atonement, Feast of Tabernacles, and the Last Great Day. Now, there's your seven annual holy days. So you get 52 weekly Sabbaths, and the seven annual Sabbaths, that's nine, that's 59 paid holidays a year. And by the way, that's where this whole concept of paid vacation comes from these Sabbaths. And that's because all of these Sabbaths are paid for by your second tithe. Yeah, that's true. There's a first tithe, there's a second tithe, there's a third tithe. There's a first resurrection, there's a second resurrection, there's a third resurrection. Yeah, one, two, three. Thought I'd throw that in there. Now, and it will be well to notice that God does not call them your Sabbaths. Or Jewish Sabbaths. A lot of people, they call them, hey, well, that's Jewish, isn't it? As so many like to say, with contempt. But the Almighty speaks of my Sabbaths. That's what I noticed in the Scripture. They're always mine. So, the Jews don't own them, and the Seventh-day Adventists don't own it. It's God that owns it. And he condemns Israel for neglecting his command, which he obviously regarded as of some extreme importance. Yeah, I'd go along with that. Nations that go into national captivity for Sabbath breaking, I would say that Sabbath has great, or at least significant importance. And it's important to reiterate that God himself rested on the seventh day, sanctified, and made that day holy as a time of rest and worship, pointing to the true God, the Creator of all. God made the Sabbath command a special and everlasting covenant between him and Israel, and he inspired example, or the inspired example, is Jesus Christ and his apostles, certainly indicates that this identifying sign of the true God ought to be observed by the true servants of God, the spiritual Israelites today. You'll see this in Romans 2, 28 and 29, Galatians 3, 28 and 29, and in Galatians 6, 15 and 16. It is an undeniable fact that every nation and every individual who has failed to remember the Sabbath has been cut off from the true God and turned to some form of pagan idolatry. For the Sabbath keeper, God is real. He is the living, active creator, the ruler of the universe. He is a God of power and activity. But the God of the Sabbath breaker evolves into a sort of essence or a harsh, stern, unreal being who is way off somewhere and is in reality such a false worship. It degenerates into carrying on a form of religious observance only because it is socially acceptable. The Sabbath guards against false religions and false gods. Now, understanding this, then, that the Sabbath command is just as binding as the commandments against murder and adultery, let us proceed to analyze and expound this command of God and its application to our personal lives today. Except for the explanatory and expository statements, the fourth commandment consists of two basic injunctions. First, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. And second, 6 days shall you labor and do all of your work. It is by the authority of God that the first 6 days of the week are appointed for man's business and labor. It is the will of God that man should work and earn his daily bread. He who idles away his time in the 6 days is equally guilty in the sight of God as the man who works on the seventh. The idle person is ordinarily clothed with rags, and his idle mind and hands leads him into many wretched vices and sins. Okay, so let me pause here for a moment, and I'll throw in my editorial comments. The Sabbath day has seven indices to it. Seven. There is a prohibition against buying, selling, or trading, which constitutes doing business. Then it's against the law to work or kindle a fire on the seventh. Kindling a fire is a part of work, labor, like kindling a fire in your truck to drive down the road or kindling a fire to make horseshoes if you're a blacksmith. And then it's a violation of the law to do your own pleasure, such as TV, sports, and unnecessary travel on the Sabbath. And then forsaking the assembly of yourselves on the Sabbath day. And then it's a day of rest. So there are seven elements here to keeping the Sabbath. Seven. You can't buy, sell, trade, or do business. You can't work or kindle a fire. You can't do your own pleasure or forsake the assembling of yourselves on the Sabbath. Now, there's a couple of positives in here. Notice it says 6 days shall you labor and do all of your work. Now, you know, we here in the Western world, we're a little smarter than God. We only work 5 days. And some of us are getting a little uppity here, and we want to cut that down to about four. We don't want to work six and rest one. We want to work five and rest two. And furthermore, we will pick the two that we're going to rest on, and that depends upon our revolving shift work, isn't it? Now, this second part of the Sabbath command is just as binding as the first. He who never works is totally unfitted for worship. The honest, purposeful work of the 6 days is in itself an act of worship and obedience to God. Man is placed in a world that contains all that is necessary for his physical being, but to obtain it, he must work. It is part of the original intention of God for man was placed in the Garden of Eden to dress it and keep it. That's called farming, and that's permanent employment. There are no unemployed people on a farm. There is no unemployment on a farm, and there is always work to be done, and work is never completed on the farm. Whoever, in like manner, he who, however, I should say, however, in like manner, he who never pauses from his daily business and permits or pursuits to worship as God has commanded on the seventh day, which God has made holy and set apart, is, through lack of contact with his Maker, rendered incapable of his highest potential achievement in work, in service, and in the joy of accomplishment. Since the very Creator has so commanded, we can keep the Sabbath day of rest and spiritual rejuvenation with complete confidence that God will bless and prosper us because we have done this. It is a paid vacation. I mentioned that to you. Now he says here that how to keep the Sabbath. Through a complete misapplication of the teachings of Jesus and his apostles, some men have tried to make the Sabbath command appear to be a yoke of bondage. They often call it Jewish with a sneer and a smirk, and they talk as if the Sabbath were some kind of hard and difficult burden to keep, as though it were a great curse to mankind. Actually, however, as many Protestant religious writers have themselves admitted, the essential Hebrew idea of the Sabbath was not that of gloom, but rather of gladness and joy. The Sabbath was a day of delight, a day in which man found in cessation from toil and labor the full understanding of his purpose and spiritual capacity. God speaks through Isaiah. He says, if you will turn away your foot from the Sabbath, from doing your pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight, the holy of the eternal, honorable, and shall honor him, not doing your own ways, nor finding your own pleasure, nor speaking your own words, then shall you delight yourself in the eternal, and I will cause you to ride upon the high places of the earth, and to feed you with the heritage of Jacob your father, for the mouth of the eternal has spoken it. Remember, that's in Isaiah 58, verses 13 and 14. Notice that God says we are to delight in his Sabbath day, and yet we are not to seek our own human pleasure. Uh-oh, can't go to the football game. But rather to increase our spiritual joy through honoring and worshiping our Heavenly Father and God. We're not even to speak our own words. Rather, we should spend the time during his or this holy day in prayer to God, studying, discussing, meditating upon God's Word, literally saturating our minds and hearts with the thoughts and character of our Father in Heaven. He goes on to say, although Christians are to live by the Spirit. Now I want to point out something here. How many Christians do you know that keep the Sabbath in this way? I don't know of any. So, when I say to people, you know, they'll ask me sometimes, Mr. Gordon, do you go to church? No. Mr. Gordon, are you a Christian? No. And why is that? Because Christians don't practice the law of God, and I try real hard to do just that. Now, I'm not opposed to Christians. Don't get me wrong, you know, I'm not throwing rocks at anybody. But I just wanted you to notice here that I don't think most people do that. This is the fourth commandment now. This is the first four commandments deal with your relationship with God. And then the following six commandments deal with your relationship with your fellow man. You know, the average Joe Sixpack on the street. And so, when we take a look at the application of the actual practice of the Ten Commandments, we find so far, Christians don't practice the first, second, third, and fourth commandments. I mean, the average Christian. There are some weirdos out there, some wild-eyed fanatics, you know, off-the-wall, right-wing, religious, radical kooks who might do these. But, you know, as a general rule, the average Joe Sixpack Christian going to church every Sunday does not practice the Ten Commandments. So, I would like to suggest that we all think about this. It may save the nation. It won't, because we won't, but it could if we would. It has in the past, but it's a very rare event. Very rare. Historically, I can only find three instances where the actual application of the law has saved any nations or city-states. It's happened three times in history. Actually, it only actually occurred twice. It could have occurred three times, but the third group that had the opportunity turned it down. It was offered to them and they said, shove off. So, it didn't work. But twice in history. Now, we Americans have been the beneficiaries of this Sabbath keeping. And we have we did have the greatest, most powerful nation, prosperous, you know, and the military power and economic power in the world. Now it's slipped. We've lost it. And it started on the slippery slope downhill in 1950. And this guy, David Barton, was able to pinpoint the year, 1962, that America's academic standards began to fall off the cliff over prayer. And I can identify 1950 as the year that America went over the cliff when we abolished the blue laws concerning religious observance in America. 1950. So we were ascending until 1950, levied off, and fell into the pit from that point on. Sabbath breaking is one of, not the only, but one of the causes of that. So, I'm going to pause right there, and I think I've just about covered my little piece on the Sabbath. I can't cover every single thing that this guy has to say about the Sabbath. I couldn't find very much at fault there with his conclusions concerning the Sabbath. And I just wanted to add to that. Now, I don't think he put in here, in his section here, the seven annual Sabbaths. And I suspect that he probably knew about Leviticus 23, and I think that you ought to take a look at Leviticus 23 as well. I think that if you practice the Sabbath day every single week, and you don't practice the annual seven annual holy days, I don't think you can make it into the kingdom. I don't believe it. Well, not in the first resurrection. I mean, you might be able to make it the second round, but I don't think the first round is in the cards. And of course, all the chosen people. There's all these people out there that are chosen. I think I'm the only guy in the world that isn't chosen. I'm sitting here at my desk, and I haven't got a clue as to whether I'm going to make the first, second, or third resurrection. I have high hopes, you know. I'd like to make the first, but you know, I'm not the guy that's going to make that decision. I'm kind of like going into an employer, and I'm making my application for employment, and I'm stating my qualifications. I've got my resume. You know, and I've put on my underarm deodorant, brushed my teeth, combed my hair, you know, wearing my best suit. I'm looking real good today. And I'm in here being interviewed by the employer. And I notice that religious people, they'll say, past tense, have you been saved? Which is like saying, have you been hired? No, I haven't completed my job interview yet. Well, have you been saved? Boys and girls, we are in the process of being interviewed. That's what life is all about. Life. 70 years of life is the job interview. I haven't completed my job interview yet. I don't know whether or not I'm going to get the job. I don't know if I'm going to be hired in the first round or the second round or finally dismissed. Can't tell you. I've got high hopes. I think I can make the first round over here. I think I'm a qualifier. I think I'm doing all the right things that this employer wants. But the employer hasn't talked to me directly yet. He hasn't given me an evaluation on my application yet. So the answer is no, I have not been saved yet. I'm not saved. Are you going to heaven? No. This employer with the emphasis very emphatically says heaven is not a part of this job description. So, no, I'm not trying to go to heaven with all the Christians out here, because this job that I'm trying to get, rulership over the nations and eternal life, does not include going to heaven. It includes staying here on the earth and ruling the nations with a rod of iron with the Messiah for 1,000 years. All right. So there's that part of that story. Let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log, schedule, and archives that can be accessed through the webpage as well. The Lauer is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Lauer programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Lauer is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Lauer brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one. They're free. And you can do that by calling direct to 417-273-4967. Once more, that's 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Lauer and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or that we recommend are going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Lauer are hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoint is not necessarily wholly endorsed by the Lauer and Editorial Review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that we use on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. And for more information, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing the book, The Ten Commandments, by Roderick C. Meredith. And we are relying upon some listener out there who knows a church, group, organization, a warehouse somewhere who has a stack of these books or is still publishing them. This thing may still be published, I don't know. And if you would call us here at the Lauer or Editorial Review and tell us, yeah, you can get this and here's where you get them and here's how much they cost and so on, then we would appreciate that. And I'll pass it on to you when I get it. Okay, we are now ready for part 5, the fifth commandment. Now that we've covered the first four commandments, the fifth commandment, youthful violence and insolence characterize the age in which we live. Broken homes are increasing. Teenage crime is literally skyrocketing. And although our juvenile population increased by less than one half from 1948 to 1960, arrests of juveniles jumped 100% in the same period. This is a shocking situation, so says U.S. News and World Report in September 26, 1960. Why youthful crime? Well, one of America's most respected authorities on juvenile problems, Judge Samuel S. Leibowitz, set out to find the answer to the frustration of America's youth. And he decided to go to the Western nation with the lowest reported incidence of juvenile crime, and that was Italy. He sought the answer from police and school officials throughout the nation, from every part of Italy. He received the same answer. Young people in Italy respect authority. Then Judge Leibowitz had to go into Italian homes to find out why. And he found that even in the poorest Italian home, the wife and children respect and honor the father as its head. Judge Leibowitz found that the modern do-as-you-please permissive world does not really make a child happy, nor is any child from such a home balanced. Rather, he found that a child wants the solid walls of discipline and rules around him, defining his world, telling him exactly how far he can go, just as will be expected of him in the adult world. A child must be disciplined to do those things that he does not necessarily want to do. From babyhood, a child must be taught to respect and obey his parents. And Judge Leibowitz concluded his investigations with a 9-word solution to juvenile delinquency. And he said, put father back at the head of the family. The remarkable answer to juvenile problems given by this eminent authority goes deeper than might be realized because it goes to the very source of the problem. It is a lack of deep-seated respect for constituted authority beginning in infancy and continuing throughout life. This problem has its origin in childhood. It has its origin in the home. Long before a child is even aware of the existence of the church, or the school, or the nation, the child is forming attitudes and habits toward those who are his superiors, in the nursery, in the home, and in the neighborhood. Developed from infancy, this part of a child's character will undoubtedly affect his thoughts and actions for the rest of his natural life. Now here's the fifth commandment stated. The first four commandments define man's relationship with God, and they teach us the magnitude of God's power and name, and they exhort us to remember Him as creator of all that is. The fifth commandment is placed first among those commandments which govern our human relationships. It is not only chief in importance among these when we understand its full meaning, but it acts as a bridge between these two sections of the Ten Commandments, the fundamental law of God. For true obedience to the fifth commandment is inevitably linked with obedience and honor toward God Himself. Our Creator knew this when He inspired it to be the first commandment with promise. It says, "Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God giveth thee." Why should we honor our parents? Well, the true answer reveals the depth of this commandment and its true import. If only every parent on earth might come to realize the tremendous influence upon a child's later life that automatically comes as a direct result of obedience or disobedience to this God-given command. This commandment is one of the 10 great points of God's eternal spiritual law. Under the Old Testament dispensation, the penalty for directly and flagrantly violating this law was death. "He that smites his father or his mother shall surely be put to death." That's a statute. Any man that strikes his father or mother should be put to death. "And he that curses his father or his mother shall be put to death." Just cursing them carries the death penalty. Now that's how important this command is to God the Creator. The home and the family unit is the basis of all society. And the relationship of children to their parents is an exact type of the spiritual relationship between true Christians and God. Notice that he uses the word true Christians as if there are false Christians. I'm going to underline that. Now the lessons of character learned in that relationship may last children the rest of their lives and for all eternity. In the eyes of a small child, a parent stands in the place of God Himself, for the parent is the child's provider, protector, lover, teacher, and lawgiver. A child's early training and response to this relationship will in large measure determine his later response to the larger relationships with society, and ultimately, it is certain to affect his relationship with his spiritual father in heaven. Honor and respect for parents. The New Testament magnifies this command in many places. The Apostle Paul wrote, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother," which is the first commandment with promise in Ephesians 6, verses 1 and 2. The original command to honor father and mother applies to all of us throughout all of our lives. But in this place, children, specifically, are told to obey their parents. Because of this total lack of experience and judgment, it is absolutely necessary that a child be taught to obey his parents instantly and without question. Explanations and reasons for this may and should be given to the child from time to time, but at the moment a parental command is given, there may not be time or opportunity to give the reason why. Therefore, it's imperative that a child be taught the habit of unquestioning obedience to his parents. For until the young child develops, his parents stand to him in the place of God, and God holds them, the parents, responsible for teaching and directing the child properly. I was raised in one of those old-timey homes. When my daddy said jump, you didn't ask why, you asked how high, was the old adage. I don't ever remember asking old dad how high, but I can always remember, yes sir. We had to use terms like yes sir and yes ma'am. And if you disobeyed, you know, early on, you know, you just get whipped. And so a child that's brought up, you know, from early childhood, you know, the onesies and terrible twosies, you know, that people complain about. I never had a child that had a problem with. Never. You just train them up from the time they're little, and you spank them, you know, when they're little pain on their butt, you know, when they're 1 year old, 2 years old. They learn very rapidly. It's like a dog or a cat, you know. You're trying to train, put a little pain to it. They associate the pain with a reward. You know, you reward your dog, you give him a biscuit, you know. You got a kid over here and you want to train him to come here. You know, it's come here, sit down, stand up. We used to call these our drills. Always taught my children their drills. I started them off, you know, when they're old enough to walk. Come here, sit down, stand up. That's the way you teach a dog, you know. Sit up, speak, sit, come, lay. Don't you teach your dog? You know, the average American can train a dog, and his kid... Oh, his kid's totally out of control. Totally out of control. Which tells me that dogs are more intelligent than children. Now, do you honest to God believe that dogs are more intelligent than children? You can train a dog, but you can't train a child. Huh? I mean, come on, kids. Let's grow up and get real, shall we? You can train dolphins and orcas, but you can't train children to mind? I can remember my dad set me in a chair, just a little tyke, you know. I was probably 3, 4 years old, 5 maybe, I don't know exactly, probably 4. Anyway, old dad set me in a chair, and I got down. He whipped me. Said, I'll tell you when to get down out of that chair. So after, you know, a couple of times, you know, I figured out I better sit in that chair. Well, one time he told me, go sit in that chair. And so I went and sat in the chair, and then he forgot me. I sat in that chair. I forgot how long my old granny told me. I was 3 or 4 hours. Hell, it was so long, I went to sleep in the chair. Got tired and just went to sleep in the chair. Then somebody came and rescued me and said, why are you sitting in that chair? Daddy told me to. I could take my children into a restaurant and tell them to sit still, shut up, speak, sit, roll over. My children were just as smart as a dog, better. My children were smarter than a dog. My children could do more tricks than any dog. I called them drills, and I taught my children drills, and my children never disobeyed me. Well, not when they were little. When they grew up, got into the army, they got a little rowdy. See, society has a bad influence on your children. Television is a bad influence on your children. In fact, that's where your children learn all of this rowdiness. Television, movies, songs, you know. Give mom and dad the finger. Tell them where to go. Well, okay, you know, you can figure that out for yourself, but there's a law here, and this law, if we would practice it, would give us obedient children. Now, one prophecy that God gave us, he said, in Isaiah, he said, children are your oppressors. No, he said no. Is that what he said? Children are your oppressors, and women rule over you. Yeah, that's what it is. Children are your oppressors, and women rule over you. Take a look at American society and see if that's not true. Down in Phoenix, Arizona, I was down there a few years ago, and I called the boy and I said, are you getting any of these reports on the news about what's going on here in Phoenix? And he said, what's going on? I said, there is a drive-by shooting going on every day down here for 16 consecutive days. Have you heard that? He said, no, haven't heard a word about it. Well, that's what I'd heard. I was down in Phoenix and picked up the Phoenix paper. 16 consecutive days, 16 consecutive drive-by shootings. Most of them they attribute to gangs. These gangs are unruly, rowdy teenagers, aren't they? These are the unrowdy, unruly teenagers that are raised in our permissive society by Dr. Spock or Dr. Spook. We didn't have that back in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. Children could mine. Children knew how to behave. Then after World War II, I don't know how this got started, but Dr. Spock and a bunch of others, you know, they got in here and they said, this fifth commandment's bad for you. The government came in and said, you can't spank these children. They used to spank kids in school. I remember when I first went to school, they stopped about 1950 to 55. When I first went to school, the worst thing that could happen to you is you misbehaved in school because the teacher would whip you. And if the teacher couldn't whip you, they'd send you down to the principal, and the principal would whip you. And then they'd send you home with a note, and the old man would whip you at home. So you could get it from the teacher, get it from the principal, and then you'd surely get it at home because you brought disrespect or disrepute upon the family name called Gordon. We didn't have any misbehavior in public school in 1945. Didn't exist in America. I can't speak for the rest of the world, but I'll tell you when I went to school, everybody minded. Mrs. Sorensen said, jump, it was how high, not why. Today, teachers don't have any power in the classroom. Principals have even less, and the parents at home are the cause of the whole malady. It's the parents at home that cannot or will not follow this fifth commandment and will not teach and force and train their children to mind. That's the bottom line. And so now we've gotten to the point where we have parental abuse, adult parental abuse. This is where you got your 25-year-old kid comes into your house, slaps you around, slaps you up alongside the head, and then takes your purse away from you, mothers. Well, you're the proximate cause of your own injury, because when that kid was 1 or 2 years old, he couldn't slap you up alongside the head. And if you'd have slapped him up alongside the head, he wouldn't be slapping you up alongside the head today. Don't you think it's about time you woke up? Now, in the Army, those drill sergeants in the Army, you know, they've got it figured out that if you want these punks, these pimply-faced punks to mind over here, you got to get control of them. So in the Army, you know, they kind of get control of you. And they can teach you how to mind in the Army. It's a tragedy that we can't teach children how to mind, you know, when they're little kids. And then it would be more pleasurable in the restaurants. God, I hate to go to a restaurant that's got kids in there. Drives me nuts. All right, so there's your honor and respect for parents. That's the fifth commandment over here. I think I'll flip through here as a common sin. To the everlasting shame of our professing Christian society, thousands of elderly parents are reduced to living on a mere pittance that comes to them through governmental agencies. In all too many cases, the children are able but simply unwilling to provide additional comforts as generous as their ability allows. Well, Jesus Christ gave one of the most forceful interpretations of the fifth commandment in its application to this very problem. In his day, men were excusing themselves from providing for the necessities of their parents. And they were saying that funds which might have been used in this way were korban, that is, dedicated to the service of the altar. These funds were not part of God's tithe, but rather an additional offering which was used to gain favor in approaching God. Reproaching these hypocritical religionists, I like that, hypocritical religionists, Jesus said, "Full well you reject the commandment of God, that you may keep your own tradition. For Moses said, honor your father and mother, and whoso causes father or mother, or curseth rather father or mother, let him die the death." That's in Mark 7, verses 9 and 10. Now notice how these hypocrites reasoned their way around this commandment. And Jesus continued, he said, "But you say if a man shall say to his father or mother, it is korban, that is to say a gift, by whatsoever thou mightest be profited by me, he shall be free, and you shall suffer him no more to do aught for his father or his mother, making the word of God of no effect through your tradition." Well, Jesus condemned these hypocrites, and his words plainly teach that a Christian person must give material and financial assistance to his aged parents if it's at all possible and their needs so require. He must not excuse himself by saying that all of this extra income or funds are dedicated to God. This is a part of our obedience to the fifth commandment. You know, today, we Americans, I can't speak for the rest of you people out there in the world, but here in America, we put our elderly parents into rest homes. Hell, we don't want to take care of them. We don't want to be burdened with them. So we tuck them away and institutionalize them. Maybe it's their just results or just deserts for having institutionalized us in public school when we started off. You ever stop to think about that? Parents. Maybe if you'd teach and train your children the Ten Commandments in your own home school instead of sending them off to the public school and teaching them and training them in the Communist Manifesto, maybe they'll treat you a little better when you get to be 75 or 80. Meanwhile, back on the farm, when I was a youngster in the olden days, we used to take care of our own parents. The last thing anybody would have thought of was sticking them in a rest home, for crying out loud. We used to have a little mother-in-law cottage. My Uncle Buster built one of those for his mother-in-law. And they took care of that old lady. Her name was Devil Bess, an old lady Devil Bess. They took care of her until the old lady died. She was never thrown out on Social Security or out on the public dole, for crying out loud. When her husband died and she was a widow, somebody had to take care of her. So my Uncle Buster took care of his mother-in-law. It was my Aunt Edith's mother. And that was the modality or the methodology by which we took care of the elderly in America. The firstborn son of the family, the patriarch of the family, takes care of his siblings in the family. And then each one of those siblings, you know, as he grows up, he becomes a patriarch in his family, and then he's got duties and obligations. This is called charity. If there's nobody else in the world to do it, then we have the church. But the first obligation is the family. That's what the fifth commandment's all about. I think Meredith did a pretty fair job here of explaining and expounding this fifth commandment. And can't add too much to that. He just kind of honor to the very end. Jesus, wisdom and youth. He's got several little sections over here describing this thing of the fifth commandment. Now this is five. We've covered half of them now, in about a halfway point here in the program. Next time we'll take up the sixth commandment, sixth and seventh, eighth, ninth, and tenth. We'll see if we can get the Ten Commandments in here with their explanations. Remember, this is the Ten Commandments written by Roderick C. Meredith. I also recommend America to Pray or Not to Pray by David Barton. Don't forget that one. Because they actually work kind of in conjunction. They're kind of like companions. And then remember I told you about Come Out of Her, My People. I think if you had these three books over here, the Ten Commandments will come alive and you'll see the importance of them in our society, both political and economic. All right, we're going to stop right there. Let me give you a final reminder that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our webpage. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.